Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. It's just about 11 o'clock, time for the Recovery Zone. Today, host Stephanie Potter speaks with professor and writer Mark Beckoff about our need to reconnect with our natural landscapes and with animals, and about his book, Rewilding Our Hearts. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Here comes the Recovery Zone.
Hi, and welcome to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guest today has written a book that makes the case that healing our world requires that we rewild our hearts. And today we're going to talk about what that means. Mark Beckoff is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's won various research awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, and has published numerous books and essays, including The Ten Trusts with Jane Goodall and The Emotional Lives of Animals. His most recent book is called Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. And Mark, we do have you on the phone, right?
Yep.
That's great. Okay. All right. And so I'd like to, and you're talking to us from Colorado, right?
Yep. Boulder, right. Colorado.
You're still there. Boulder, Colorado. So you've written some, I think, 22 books. And I just wanted to ask, what made you want to write this one? What's different or special about it?
Well, this book is really broader than any of my other books. I've written essays about, you know, reconnecting with nature, which, of course, includes reconnecting with other humans as well as other animals and their homes. But this one is really more of a sort of a plea for some personal transformation to rewild ourselves and become re-enchanted with nature as a whole. So, of course, non-human animals play a role in it, but it really is more reconnecting with other nature and, like to say, from the inside out, that we need to follow what our hearts, are telling us about the, if you will, the right way to interact with other nature.
And it's called Rewilding Our Hearts, but it's also connected. At the beginning, you talked about rewilding in the conservation movement and tried to make a link there. Could you talk about that exactly, like how the conservation movement is trying to do rewilding?
Yeah, I mean, the word rewilding has been around for a while, but it first appeared, or it again appeared, directly in the early 90s with projects that were concerned with building corridors so that animals could move freely, using overpasses, underpasses, and areas where there weren't humans. One of the most famous would be the Y2Y, excuse me, I got to get a drink of water, but the Y2Y corridor, the Yukon to the Yucatan.
Yukon to Yellowstone? Yucatan, all the way down to the Yucatan?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really ambitious project.
Wow. As far as,
yeah, and of course, it would have gone through Yellowstone.
Okay.
But the major goal there was to have these corridors or pathways for uninterrupted travel. So I was thinking about it in terms of pathways, I mean, literally in our body, that would go from our hearts if you will, to our heads and to our muscles and to our thought patterns for interacting. And when I talk to people who were involved with the original rewilding project, they never thought of personal rewilding. You know, it was always more on a sort of outdoor nature scale.
And it has to do with also like cores and carnivores. And I was actually thinking that a core, like in French, a core is heart, that there's some kind of core heart energy even with the idea of core.
Yep, that's exactly it. And in fact, the earlier rewilding projects focused a lot on carnivores. But then, of course, people rightfully expanded them, the ideas to other animals. But, you know, in terms of rewilding, too, it came to me that through life itself, people are busy, through education, we all become unwilded. And so really what we need to do is undo the unwilding, which is really rewilding.
Right, and so I want to talk about unwilding. It's like what? How is it? I mean, what we were wild in a sense is what you're saying, and what is it that made us unwild? Is it some kind of domestication thing? Is it? I mean, what exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, education.
And domestication.
Yeah, I mean, humans are not really domesticated. I know people like to talk about us as being domesticated, but. You know, pigs, cows, dogs, cats, of course, are domesticated, you know, animals. But I think the unwilding came along, and maybe not that long ago. I mean, I hadn't thought about it, but I think, you know, probably humans maybe 100 years ago or maybe 200 years ago were, quote, wilder and more connected to nature than we are now. The Industrial Revolution, of course, and then formalized education, you know, having kids sit in a classroom all day, having recesses be sort of, you know, recesses, you know, go out the door, you know, sometimes when they need to spend more time at their desks. Just kids not getting out into nature, you know, Richard Love, who wrote stories, you know, books about the nature deficit disorder, wrote the foreword for my book, and I was really happy because he identified that, you know, situation where kids are not getting outside and they actually, if you will, suffer from some sort of nature deficit.
And the whole idea of that then is that we're kind of out of touch. We're sort of more run by clocks. We're trying to live like machines, and we've lost track of being part of nature. And what has that done to us?
Right. It's alienated us from nature. It's in, you know, in many ways, it's alienated us from ourselves as well. Busyness, not paying attention to the fact that we are an integral part of nature, not a part from nature. You know, the rewilding idea also plays off of, you know, something that so many people experience. When you're having a bad day, you go out and take a walk. You play with your dog. You might, you know, look outside and see squirrels playing or birds flying, and it makes you feel better. So it's sort of tapping into that innate, if you will, genetic attachment we have to nature. There's a word for it called biophilia that was made popular by the great biologist Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson. And biophilia really refers to this real innate and genetic drive to connect with nature.
Yeah, I recently just saw, I was wandering the internet, and a fellow who was like a photographer, but he was laying on the sand next to a pod of seals, and some of the seals, especially some younger ones, started to crawl on top of him, and he was giggling like a kid. He just,
right.
He was just so happy to be there with them, and that's kind of like the sense of just the joy that being in that situation can bring us. We've sort of lost touch with that.
Right. Yeah, we really have. And we've really lost touch with, like I said, that we are really part of nature. And that when we are alienated, we lose respect for other nature. And sometimes we lose respect for, you know, ourselves. And so that's why I look at my ideas about rewilding are really personal and transformative, if you will, that each and every individual who can do something needs to reconnect and do something for our planet.
And part of that, one more thing, and then I want to talk more about the rewilding itself. There's this concept called human exceptionalism that is also a part of that. Like you were talking about how it leads to a sense of we don't care about other creatures. We just really dominating them, turning them into slaves. It's like a complete, the only species that matters is human beings. And it's led us down a pretty scary track.
Right. You know, it gets back to, for some people, to the word dominion, which people have interpreted wrongly as, you know, domination. But right, rewilding forces us to face the fact that we're mammals, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but we are biologically mammals, and forces us to face the fact that we make too many of us, and we overconsume, and we leave really big footprints. And the minute I say that, people go, oh, you're really down on humans. I'm not. I really like human beings. But we need to face who we are. And by having, you know, overpopulation, overconsumption, and basically leaving huge footprints, we've really decimated our planet. So rewilding really calls for also revisiting who we are as mammals.
Right, and getting past the population overshoot somehow, dealing with climate change somehow, and trying to reverse some of these species extinctions that are going on that are just huge.
Right. I mean, we're not going to get back what we had, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, we're just not. But we can work very hard to keep what we have and maybe move into new directions, if you will. But, you know, there's not going to ever be the wild, wild west as it was because of, you know, our intrusions into innumerable habitats. But when I say that's okay, I don't mean that's okay in a permissive way. What I mean is that's the way it is. You know, there's a real world out there. And so we need to accept the fact that we're forcing other animals, humans and non-humans, to change their lives. And at some point, you know, push is going to become shove. There's just not going to be enough land nor resources to support all of us and all of the other animals.
Right. And the last little bit on this is that like you say, that this is the way it is now. It's like, I think people were talking a long time about what we called the Holocene, and now people are starting to call our era the Anthropocene or something like that. That we, it's kind of a man world in a way, or a human world.
Right. Yeah, the Anthropocene, you know, sort of the age of humanity. And I always say that there's nothing humane about the age of humanity. But you're right, you know, people look at it as a new geological epoch. And it's, you know, leading into or we're part of the sixth major extinction. And we're losing species at an unprecedented rate compared to what people would call the background rate. You know, there would be maybe an expected... there'd be expected attrition and extinctions, but we're thousands of times ahead of that, if you will, for some species. So, you know, there is always going to be species coming and going due to ecological changes and habitat changes. But as, you know, in the Anthropocene, we're the cause. And you said something that's so true about climate change, you know, that climate change is having devastating effects on numerous species. It just is. And, you know, if we could stop it right now, which we're not going to stop it today, then that would be, well, you know, once again, that would be really beneficial. But some of the losses are permanent losses. Some of the losses are irreversible.
Yeah, like melting ice caps and things. It's pretty incredible. But I want to let
Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth again last week.
Ah.
And oh my, it seemed almost more powerful now than when, you know, I first saw it, what, 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, it really did, because it was so prophetic in a sense. And you know, people said, oh, you know, back then people said, oh, he's just an alarmist. Well, no, he was just reporting the data, and we need to pay attention to the data.
I know. And it's amazing to me that so many people are still arguing that it's even a reality. But I want to let listeners know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. And my guest today is Mark Beckoff, an ecologist and evolutionary biologist whose latest book is called Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. And if you'd like to call in and add to the conversation, the number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187. I want to get back to actually the title of your book, Rewilding Our Hearts. So what is it exactly? Like, for instance, is it changing how we think or I mean, how do we activate this energy in our heart?
Yeah, it's a combination, if you will, of changing how we feel, and how we feel, you know, influences what how we think. And, you know, there's a reciprocal relationship between thinking and feeling, and then how we basically use that those feelings that emerge to act. In other words, you know, we feel really good when we're outside. We feel really good when we do good things. And, you know, likewise, when we do things that, you know, we wish we hadn't done or said, we don't feel good about it. So it's really harnessing what our heart is telling us, and those positive feelings we have when, you know, you just go outside and take a walk. I mean, this morning I just kind of got up and I went outside on my deck, and I didn't, you know, some people would say, well, you did nothing. No, I was looking at the beautiful Flatirons here in Boulder, Colorado, as the sun was coming up, and it was really exhilarating. And I, you know, basically said to myself, my goodness, Mark, you're lucky to be alive. You know, you're lucky to be outside.
Yeah.
And then having that energy, you know, motivate us or motivate individuals to do good things. And for some people, it's going to be spiritual and it's going to be transformative. But I think that's what we really need. We just can't continue going on the way we are going, because the world, I like to say the world is tired. You know, I wrote in the book about how a lot of people say, isn't it wonderful that nature is so resilient? Well, nature isn't as infinitely resilient. And I've had arguments with people who go, no, you know, nature bounces back. Well, you know as well as I do, the glaciers aren't bouncing back.
Right.
Populations of wolves who were decimated in Yellowstone wouldn't have bounced back without the repatriation, you know, reintroduction program.
Right. And the whole idea of resilience is that, I mean, that's critical, but there are these things called J curves, you know,
yeah,
that look pretty ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in that sense, the word, you know, once again, it's really a positive transformative process. And the other thing is, it doesn't require people to be wealthy and, you know, contribute millions of dollars to some cause or found an organization. It's really the little things. I always like to say, you know, it's not my original term, but act locally and think globally.
Right.
So there's just little things people can do to help others. And I really want to stress the fact that part of rewilding really means helping other humans, because scientific research is showing that non-human animals and human animals are basically kind and compassionate and empathic. And it's really only a tiny percentage of the population that isn't. Of course, that tiny percentage has a lot of power. But cross-cultural research in humans and research in non-human animals is showing that most of their behavior is predominantly positive or pro-social, it's called.
So it's not like a dog-eat-dog world out there. It really is much more cooperative, compassionate, kind.
Yeah, that's our innate predisposition, our inherited, if you will, predisposition, and so too of other animals. So, for example, research has been done on non-human primates has shown that across the board in all species, more than 90%, and in some cases more than 95% of their behavior is cooperative and pro-social. People misinterpret when I say that and say, oh, well, what about the fights they have? Nope. non-human animals fight with one another, and occasionally they harm one another. But it's very rare that that happens, but it catches attention. And so, you know, the other part, one part of the rewilding paradigm is to rewild media so that when people do horrible things, the newscasters don't say that they were acting like animals. And that's really common. It's not hard to go online or pick up a newspaper or magazine and read about some horrific event and have the newscaster say, well, they were just acting like animals.
Right. There, and that's a real denigrative sort of term, isn't it? To be
Oh, absolutely. I've been teaching a course at the Boulder County Jail for about 15 years. And when I went to, when I proposed the course, of course, at first the people at the jail, the jail administrator, they were interested, but the administrators kind of laughed. And I said, well, you know, they behave like animals. And I said, no, one of the main lessons, and I'm still doing it years later, is that when one of the other guys, you know, guys tell the other guy, hey, look, you know, you're behaving like an animal, I always say you complimented him, and that gets into long discussions.
Oh, that's great.
So it is a denigrative term. But, like, once again, I just want to say, human animals fight, non-human animals fight, but it's very rare. And when you really think about it, and I know people think that I'm being sarcastic, when you think about the very few people who run countries, when I mean few, you know, compared to the percentage of, say, the population, it's just relatively few who, you know, you might cash out as warmongers, and some of them probably don't want to do what they're doing, but they do politically. So I really mean that seriously. And once again, there's a wonderful book called Super Cooperators that really shows cross-culturally that there's far more cooperation among humans than we would ever imagine. And so my argument is, once again, we need to tap into who we really are as part of that rewilding process.
And that's partly like what your animal studies are all about. And to me, like, another thing that you got into about animals is about how they like to play. And mm-hmm. I love those rules, the play rules. Could you say what those were?
Yeah, I mean, I've been studying animal play for ages. And one of the things that I noticed very early on was how fairly they play. And of course, the minute I say that, people go, oh, whenever I go to the dog park, dogs, you know, dogs play and then they fight. It actually, studies have shown that it's about 1-2% of the time. But once again, it catches your attention. So the studies of play that I've done really show that I've focused on dogs, wolves, and coyotes, that animals play fairly and they really try very hard to maintain the rules of the game. So they've evolved different signals and behaviors so that they don't violate the rules of the game. So if I'm playing with you and I bite you too hard, I may do a play signal to say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. And then you forgive me and we play. Or likewise, I may go, oh, I'm just going to bite her really hard or jump on her. But I want her to know this is play, so I'm going to use a play signal to say this is play before I do it. So many animal species, including humans, once again, have evolved play signals to basically indicate the intention to play, although I'm going to do something that could be misinterpreted as not play.
That's like when we tease each other, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's like if I see you and I kind of approach you in a very light gait and I, you know, pat you on the shoulder and you kind of fall over, you know, you realize that I didn't intentionally push you over. I actually did a study here on campus a few years when I studied when I taught animal behavior, of having males and females approach one another, either in a very playful way or non-playful way, and sort of slap someone on the back lightly, and then go, "Oh, I thought I knew you." And across the board, when a person was approached in a very loose gait, they were not as put off. In fact, they often weren't put off as if, you know, I rushed up to you and patted you on the back. And so there's lots of examples in non-human animals where those mechanisms really work to basically, you know, once again, send the signal, this is play, not aggression or predation or reproduction.
And so basically, like, you're really emphasizing that we are not exceptional animals. We are animals too. I mean, we sort of evolved to have the same kind of ways of behaving as a lot of animals do.
Right.
We just use language.
We do amazing things. I mean, you know, no other animals build computers or airplanes or cars, and I don't mean that facetiously. So we are exceptional, but my line is, so too are other animals, that they do things we can't do.
Right.
You know, they use ultrasound, high-pitched sounds and low-pitched sounds to communicate. They fly. We don't fly. They're stronger than us, if you will, you know, per, say, body mass. And so what I like to say is that, you know, all animals are exceptional, but when people start talking about human exceptionalism, what happens is it immediately gets translated into, we are better, more valuable, more worthwhile, more worthy. And that's where, you know, I think things go wrong.
Right. And you were back to the play thing, just real quick. I was going to say these rules: ask first, be honest, follow the rules, and admit you're wrong. And I just love those rules. And it's like, if we all live like that, you know, what a different world, you know?
Yeah, it really would be. Yeah, it would be. And those rules, like I said, really, they cross species, including humans, because I've done work with kids playing in playgrounds. And once again, those same rules really apply. And I was just telling somebody a few days ago that I talk a bunch with school psychologists and teachers who want to use animal models of fair play to basically teach, or, you know, tell youngsters that, once again, when you really, you can roughhouse, but when you do it and you violate the rules of the game, you're not behaving like an animal.
You're behaving like a human.
an unwilded
human.
Yeah, no, exactly. Right. And so, see, part of the rewilding is, like I said, it's unwilding. It's really getting back to our roots. And I really think, you know, when you look at a lot of the physiology that's being done, like on the hormone oxytocin, and some work that's being done on looking at, you know, brain scans of people outside, it really shows clearly that, you know, once again, our natural state is one of living in harmony. I know to some people it sounds like, you know, a lot of fluff. They say, oh, you live in Boulder, Colorado. You know, maybe you get that out in Portland and Eugene and all that. But no, it's not a function of living at high altitude in beautiful Boulder. It's really a function of, that's who we are. And I think as people become, you know, aware of this and really embrace it, it's going to be easier for them to reconnect with other nature.
Yeah, and actually, like, one of your quotes was, this reconnection includes animals to the extent that they must be factored into raising our global consciousness in a troubled and wounded world. That was a quote that I read that just really struck me as very right on, that we can't ignore animals. You know, it's like, I think we get a sense that, you know, okay, now we've got our 3D printers and we can print, you know, new blood vessels for ourselves. Or, I mean, I've just read these amazing things that we can do, where we can kind of just, and then lost in our movies and our computers, but forgetting animals and just using them as products, it just is really going haywire, you know.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things I always say, it's just interesting that a lot of really good people who are, you know, interested in conservation projects, environmental ethics, environmental problems, and projects, they don't do it intentionally, but you could have these long, day-long discussions, and the word animal or discussion of the animals who live in a certain area never comes up.
And so you're trying to emphasize that they need us to recognize that they're emotional, that they're sentient, that they're intelligent, that they have a real personality and consciousness, that needs to be something that's part of our thinking.
Right. I always say the animals care about what happens to them, and so should we. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
There's, you know, mounting evidence that animals who are exploited are stressed. There was just a study of wolves published last week that showed that wolves who are hunted show very high levels of stress hormones. It changes reproductive cycles, and it changes the basic social structure of wolf packs. I mean, so you know, we just can't say that our presence, you know, has no effect on these other animals. And so, once again, you know, these animals are emotional, sentient, and feeling beings who care about what happens to them, and care, you know, they care about what happens to their families and friends as well.
Right, and it's all just so important. This is KBOO Portland, the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm speaking with Mark Beckoff, activist, scientist, and professor emeritus, associated with the University of Colorado in Boulder. Also has a huge background in animal behavior and cognitive ethology. And today we're talking about his book, Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways to Compassion and Coexistence. You're welcome to call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. And you were talking about working in the conservation movement. There is something called the compassionate conservation movement. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, compassionate conservation focuses on the well-being and the welfare of individual animals. And it's a very significant move. People who are interested in conservation and environment focus a lot on species, populations, and ecosystems. And once again, it's not that they're heartless, but they're willing to trade off, say, the life of one wolf for the good of other wolves, or the life of certain birds for the good of other birds. There's been a debate, actually, out in Oregon, where it's been proposed to kill cormorant birds to save salmon. So compassionate conservation argues that the life of all individuals counts, and that we shouldn't be, you know, for example, we shouldn't be trading off the life of one animal for the life of one animal for the good of another animal. And in the last 4 years, it's become global and very influential. And I'm thrilled because I'm talking with people who I was always willing to talk to, but they may not have been willing to talk to me. So there's been recent debates about killing one species of owl, barred owls, to save another species of owl, and I'm against that. And so the fact that I'm against it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that something won't be done, but at least our voices are being heard.
You're so putting it out there that every individual matters, basically.
Yes. Right.
And can this actually work, though? I mean, like, see, I can see where it starts to get complicated. How do we save individuals? How do we save species? How do we save whole ecosystems? How can this all kind of be woven together into something that actually works?
That's a great question, and I'm not going to try to fool you or me into thinking I have an answer. But what it does is it calls attention to the fact that each individual counts. It calls attention to the fact that they have feelings. It also calls attention to the fact that some projects in the past in which animals were killed wantonly just haven't worked. And so because they haven't worked, we can revisit, you know, what was done and see if there are other more humane alternatives. So, you know, not all people, even in the environmental movement or conservation movement, favor killing, you know, one animal to save another animal. It's you know, when I say it's easy to do, I mean it's pretty convenient. You know, you just go out and you kill them, and then you hope that populations of the other species, you know, rebound.
Right, but and you're trying to get people to think about this. By the way, we have a caller on the phone, Ariel. Yeah. Ariel, are you there? I don't have Ariel. It looks like.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Ariel. Okay, so what would you like to ask or talk about?
Oh, well, I just wanted to share with the listeners, an idea that would kind of answer to this question of how to rewild your own life. About a decade ago, I started out to train and then to develop a local food initiative. And I thought that I was learning, you know, small agriculture and sustainable practices and developing a business. But really what happened was I ended up totally revamping who I was as a person. And I actually turned into the animal side of me again, just in the process of being outside every day in the natural elements without any, you know, buffer between me and nature. And so I cleared out my mind, my brain, literally in the mechanical sounds of, you know, civilization, so to speak. And I reconnected with, you know, the very subtle other animal reality that's around us all, because I would be, you know, outside every day and the birds would start to relate to me and they would start to communicate to me, you know, and all the animals. I had like cities of animals all around me on this acreage. But anyway, what that did, the process of learning how to grow food on a small commercial scale, was it rewilded me as the early version of man. We need to use our bodies every day outside in some way. And so it not just gives us a connection to growing food, you know, that we eat, it also gives us a chance to use all of our muscle groups. If all of our senses get recalibrated with the situation of the planet that we happen to be on at that moment.
And it sounds like you also connected to the world around you a lot more deeply.
Yeah.
And so, Mark, would you have a comment on that?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that comment. That's exactly what it is. Your experience is exactly the rewilding experience. When I was in New York City last year, I was walking through Central Park, and I always stop and watch animals. So I stopped and watched squirrels, and some kids came over and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm watching the squirrels." And I think their mom or someone else said, "Oh, they're just squirrels." Well, I said, "Well, yeah, they're just squirrels." And so we started watching them, and I basically taught the kids how to study squirrel behavior in 5 minutes. And they were so excited, and they said, "Well, we can't wait to come back again." You know, so that was a form of rewilding. And I think what Stephanie said too, is your show the Recovery Room?
Recovery Zone, yeah.
Recovery Zone, good. I just last week, you know, books are works in progress, ideas are works in progress. I started thinking of rewilding as rehabilitation and recovery. And really, you know, that's exactly, I think, you know, what Stephanie's getting to. It rehabs people. It allows it allows them to recover who they are. I appreciate it. I really think what you just said really shows how easy it is, like I was saying before, to rewild.
So, Ariel, thank you. I think we have another caller, Annalisa.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you, Stephanie, for all your good programming. Anyway, I participated last year in the rescue of a bee swarm that was outside of a very small fourplex. And they were on the wall, and I called KABU for a person that I know at KABU. Anyway, they called me back. When I called, beekeeper called me back and came over real fast because the landlord of that building had called an exterminator. Anyway, he rescued the bees, and now I have 2 beehives in my backyard.
Nice.
And it's wonderful to see them in action. They are very intelligent. Yep. I have a bird bath, and I keep it filled, especially during the summer. I kept it filled with water. And changed the water for clean water, and every day they were there, and they kept birds away while they were there the bird bath.
The bees kept the birds away.
Yes, and the birds know about bees.
Right.
And they stayed away, and then when the bees left, then the birds came to drink water again. Anyway, I'm in my own recovery zone, and I do my best to keep woodpeckers. I have two different pairs of woodpeckers that come once in a while. I see them, and I try to keep them with feed and things. Anyway, thanks for the program. And
I think just watching wildlife, like I have squirrels in my yard, and I'm trying to sort of start a little bird sanctuary back there with like wild plants and the bird bath. And we had a beehive too, which stung my husband pretty badly. but I don't care. It was just fun having all this sort of commotion going on in our backyard all the time. It's interesting to watch. The acrobatics of squirrels are just incredibly fascinating and fun to watch. I think it's great to have animals in my life. I just would wish that we could all do that instead of having these sort of desert scapes and cement, et cetera. But there's another thing about this, too, that I was thinking. There was something that you were referring to in your book called deep ethology, and I was going to ask you what that was about.
Yeah, that sort of was a play off of deep ecology. And deep ethology is really identifying with the animals you study. So the seer, if you will, the person, the seer becomes the seen. The animals who are being seen. And it's a dropping of all barriers. And I've had the great fortune of studying various animals, wild coyotes. I've done some work on wolves, penguins in Antarctica, birds around my mountain home. And I always say that I try as hard as I can to become coyote. I try as hard as I can to become penguin. And the other aspects of deep ethology would be, once again, honoring that these animals have feelings and care what happens to them. They have, I like to say, they have a point of view, and that I shouldn't be interpreting what they do in terms of the way I interpret or see the world. So it's really a deep identification with who the animals are, not what they are, what they need, what they want. And once again, that's part of rewilding, trying to understand who these animals are and, you know, what they need and want. And some people say, oh, you know, you don't ever know what other animals want and need. And I just go, no, that's just an excuse not to pay attention to who they are. All animals want to live in peace and safety just like we do. And then we need to tweak it to what their specific needs and wants are. But the overall need is, you know, no animal wants to subject himself or herself to a painful, stressful existence.
Right. And this idea that they're different, and to sort of get a feeling for that difference, I was able to interview David Abrams once, and his book, Becoming Animal, there was this whole feeling of, like, for instance, the birds have this real sensitivity to wind drafts and how the air feels and the way it's blowing, or the way the heat and the rising vapors and the cold downdrafts, and that they're just totally like immersed in a world that we don't even understand, just flying around. Or how another animal, you know, with its sense of smell, lives in such a different world than we do with our eyesight. And they're very mysterious in a way, that way, but also we can imagine it, you know, if we allow ourselves to go there.
Yeah, right. And, you know, one way I tell people that it's a good way to rewild, if you live with a cat or a dog, they have very different sensory systems than we do. And so there's sounds that they find appealing, sounds that are very stressful, odors that, you know, they love that we are repulsed by, and odors that they may find off-putting. And so, once again, part of rewilding could be paying more attention to who your companion dog or cat or parrot or goldfish or hamster or guinea pig is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is a
good conversation, because it really stresses that rewilding doesn't require an enormous effort. And I'm not saying it shouldn't. I mean, but, you know, a lot of people, they're just too busy. They're just too tied up in their busy day to stop and smell the roses. And when I was doing an interview recently, I said, that's another way of rewilding. Stop and smell the roses. Stop and look at a beautiful tree stop and watch the birds and the squirrels or other animals who are just there. Yeah.
And these would be some of the ways of reincorporating, rewilding just in our day-to-day life. I want to let listeners know, again, you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. My guest today is Mark Beckoff. He's an ecologist, cognitive ethologist, background in animal behavior. His latest book is called Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. And again, if you'd like to call in, the number here is 503-231-8187. But let's talk more about what needs to be done. One of the things that was interesting to me is you talked about what's called the biophilic city. And I was going to ask you what that looks like and where that's happening. How do we do it?
Right. And I was going to say that, you know, when we were talking to Ariel, cities are just really incorporating, non-human animals into their environs. Biophilic cities like Toronto has a very bad reputation for having skyscrapers and buildings that are glass and really disorient birds, for example. So there's a move to change that, making buildings more friendly to animals, preserving corridors, if you will, or pathways in the city for animals, you know, where people can go, but they have to be very careful. Amsterdam is very good about that. So biophilic cities, once again, plays off that notion of biophilia, our innate attraction to other animals and nature. And so, yeah, there's a website called Biophilic Cities, in fact, that your listeners may find interesting. And it's just working to, really make cities more user-friendly for non-human animals. You know, having gardens on a roof will then attract birds and insects. So, yeah.
And there is a lot of that. And also this includes, like, not regarding animals so much as pests. I mean, for instance, like raccoon exterminators or that kind of thing.
Yes. Oh, right. I mean, yeah, I write about that. I mean, the notion of an animal becoming a pest is really a human sort of, oriented notion. You know, I live in the, I don't now, but I lived in the mountains outside of Boulder for years, and I had cougars and black bears and foxes and coyotes at my door. And people would move there to have those experiences, and then a lot of them would just leave when the animals became a nuisance or a pest. Exactly. So once again, part of that rewilding paradigm would be to look at the, animals, once again, for whom they are and why we're there. So I know a lot of people live in the mountains, and just like me, we've had to change our habits. I've had 3 encounters with cougars where I've been within like 3 feet of them by mistake. but I don't expect people to shoot them or move them. I have to change my behavior, or I can move. Thank you. So once again, it's having these animals around and appreciating who they are and learning their habits and then changing ours, once again, is part of rewilding. And it accepts the fact that in order to peacefully coexist, we need to accept them for not only who they are, but, what they do, what their behavioral habits are.
And another big thing that people can do, I interviewed Will Tuttle last year, he kind of just, like, reading his book, it was like, oh gosh, I'm getting to the egg chapter. Oh no, I don't know if I can eat eggs anymore. Oh gosh, the milk chapter. But he kind of turned me into a vegan. I mean, I have my lapses now and then, but for the most part, I'm really trying to avoid animal products when I eat, because I just really finally got it, the suffering that goes on for animals being used for purposes other than their own.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could, are you a vegan yourself?
I am. And, once again, I like to say it's who's for dinner, not what's for dinner. It's who we're wearing, not what we're wearing. Because these animals are sentient beings. And so the words count. And so, yes, part of rewilding could be changing our meal plans. I didn't really play off of that very much in my new book because I don't want people looking at the rewilding message as being, say, an animal rights message. I'm not saying the animal rights messages aren't okay, But I want people to realize, just like your call, you know, the people who called in, and we're talking about your own experiences, that we can rewild with, certainly with respecting other animals for whom they are. But also, there's lots of other ways to rewild. But yes, we could certainly rewild by changing our food habits and our fashion habits. Yeah.
And we have a caller, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, could you just do it quickly because we're going to be running out of time, but what would you like to talk about?
Well, biophilia, the subject is addressed really directly and beautifully by Bjork in an album called Biophilia.
Yep.
And we want to get in touch with that. There's information there, but also the sense of nature is ancient. I just wanted to share that.
Nature is ancient.
Yeah, thank you. That's really important. Thank you.
Yeah, basically way before we were here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I also talk about, you know, people, when I started writing this and talking to a lot of people, they were talking about, you know, what does the word wild mean? And, you know, wild's a slippery slope. What's wild today, you know, what we consider wild, you know, years ago, it, just so little really exists. There's so much building that we're displacing other animals. And not only are we displacing other animals, we're destroying beautiful landscapes. So part of rewilding, like I said before, is appreciating the landscapes.
Yeah, basically reconnecting again with our sense of what is beautiful.
Exactly, right. So there's a very strong aesthetic component to rewilding. And like I said, part of the aesthetic component for me, and I know I'm not alone, is, God, I just love listening to birds sing. And I was thinking before, you know, the very famous book Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. The reason we need to act is we need to act before it's too late. So people noticed the absence of birdsong, for example, due to insecticides. I have people calling me or emailing me all the time saying, you know, I live in a certain part of Boulder or up in the mountains, and I don't see coyotes anymore. I don't see western even grosbeaks. I don't see bears. And so it's that absence. And so part of being proactive, part of rewilding, is being proactive so that we don't lose other species and then have it be impossible to regain them.
Right. Actually, I live pretty close on downtown in Portland, but there was a coyote in my backyard last year, and I was beyond thrilled. It was amazing.
Right.
But I was going to ask you sort of to finish here, or to get close to finishing. How do you keep from being overwhelmed, though, by the bad news? I mean, how do you just sort of, I mean, there is a lot we can do, and basically you're seeing a lot of people doing it. Is that kind of what keeps you sort of going?
Well, maybe in my book I wrote about burnout, because a lot of people who work on environmental, ecological, animal, and also human problems suffer from what psychologists call secondary trauma. You begin to identify with the situation, and they burn out. They just can't do it anymore. I don't mean that in a negative way. And so I am always looking for what works, not what doesn't work. I don't sit around. Negativity to me is a time and energy bandit. They just destroys me. And one of the things I do, and I am very happy the fact that I have not burned out over decades of doing this work, is I work hard, I play hard, and I rest hard. And I, as one of my friends who's a psychologist says, I step away from my cortex. And I do. It doesn't mean the problems go away. It doesn't mean they're not important. But what it means, it allows me to rekindle myself. You know, the analogy, you know, you have to fill your car with gas. I mean, that's time-worn, but you do. You get to the point where you run out of gas. And so I prevent myself from running out of gas by playing hard, working hard, and resting hard, but also by embracing all the wonderful people in the world. I travel a lot. There's amazing people all over the world doing whatever they can for other humans, for other animals, and for all of our homes. So that's, it's really invigorating.
Yeah, conservationists, people who are running wildlife sanctuaries or farm animal sanctuaries, people who are trying to like change cities and change. I mean, there is like, and you had a lot of that listed in your book, which is a great book, by the way.
Thank you. And
do you want to like let people know your website and how to get in touch with or find out about you more?
Yeah, my homepage is just markbeckoff.com, markbeckoff.com. And I've got a website for an organization that I co-founded with Jane Goodall called Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So you could find me either way, but markbeckoff.com is really the way to get to me.
Okay, and is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, no, I mean, I really appreciate this interview. You've asked all the good questions. Some are tough questions. And I love the fact that a couple of people called in and showed how easy it is to rewild, because that's one of the things I hear a lot. Oh, I'm so busy. Oh, I don't have time. Someone else will do it. Oh, my kids are all tied up in all these, you know, activities that are structured. And I'm thinking, let them be kids. I always say, let kids be the animals they're supposed to be. And there's a great organization called Play Wales, which is very concerned with letting kids be kids. And their slogan is, better a broken bone than a broken spirit. And to me, that little one-liner captures everything.
Yeah, Play Wales. Okay, that's another thing to check out.
Yeah.
So anyway, I want to thank you very much for being on KBOO. And let the listeners know, you've been hearing from Mark Beckoff, animal activist, professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado. So Mark, thanks so much for being on KBOO.
I appreciate it. If anybody has any questions, they can find me and email me.
Okay. And we've been talking about his recent book, Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. It's a beautiful book. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I want to thank Tammy for her excellent engineering, and thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. 91.9 FM in Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and of course around the world at KBOO.FM. And it's time for Jazz Lives.